AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at rubrik.com. That's rubrik.com.
When one hears the name Mark Twain, the most immediate associations are made between the author and two of his giant works, Tom Sawyer and Huckleberry Finn. And when Huckleberry Finn is discussed, especially by those who only have surface knowledge of the man, a miniature debate ensues about the proliferate use of the N-word, an issue that has had, at a number of cultural inflection points, seen the book banned in schools, libraries, and occasionally the bookstore. And when I brought Ron Chernow's brand new 2025 biography, Mark Twain, that's the title, to the counter to purchase it on Father's Day, I had the clerk selling me the book talk about the tensions between Twain's immense fame and influence and how they particularly didn't like Huckleberry Finn for the above-stated reasons. It turns out they also never read the book, but this isn't a mic drop about the proprietary use of the word in a book that literally decries slavery as an ultimate injustice wrapped in misguided Old Testament rationales. It's about how little Twain, with his immense volume of work, rarely has the lens widened beyond those two incredible works to the general public. He was a complex, sensitive, vain, restless, and curious man who, after using pen names like Thomas Jefferson Snodgrass, Josh, Rambler, Grumbler, John Snooks, and W. Epaminondas Adrastus Blab, would decide to eschew his given name of Samuel Langhorne Clemens for his ultimate nom de plume, Mark Twain. Ron Chernow, a man whom Lin-Manuel Miranda most likely has on speed dial after crafting an entire musical based on his Hamilton biography, has written a massive look at the man's life. I will attempt to talk about the immediate aftermath of my arriving at the 1,033rd page just the other day and how I will never see my own literary hero in the exact same way. And that's a good thing. On box number 7. It's not entirely fair to make it sound like Mark Twain's legacy hasn't been written. I mean, in fact, I don't doubt that there's ever been more research done on a singular American figure or possibly any other literary figure in history other than Mark Twain. Like I said, American or otherwise. In fact, Ron Power's biography called Mark Twain: A Life is about as good as it gets. One can read that book and walk away confident they have a deep understanding of the man and what made him tick. But Ron Chernow's book does something slightly different. Instead of a more aerial view, we are taken, maybe not consciously by the author, on this long riverboat trip, ironically, through the life of Mark Twain, making stops at individual ports, spending time there, getting to know the lay of the land, and then moving on to the next town. It literally feels like a daily ledger. From Hannibal, Missouri, where Halley's Comet was visible in the sky the day of his birth, all the way to Reading, Pennsylvania, at Stormfield House, where Halley's Comet was also visible on a return trip, fulfilling Mark Twain's prophecy about when exactly he knew he would die. So by the time Mark Twain takes his final breath, I actually felt like I'd been a part of his life. So many moments feel contemporary in terms of human condition, human fault, human frailties, and certainly the vanities of superstardom that contributed to a universe of regrets at the end of his life. Mark Twain was in fact the first universal celebrity that could cause a crowd to form anywhere he went, practically in the world. His appeal transcended the American shores and became, as they say today, viral. So I don't need to cover the established timelines of his life. You know, the dreams of riverboat pilothood in Hannibal, a riverboat boiler explosion that would kill his own brother, his journeys out west via stagecoach through Utah, and even his encounters with Brigham Young, the Mormons, and his incredibly acidic and satirical treatment of the Book of Mormon. His ultimate arrival in Nevada and his independent journalistic work for the Territorial Enterprise in Virginia City, Nevada, as well. Twain was caught up in gold and silver prospecting like everyone else, and while living on top of a place called Jackass Hill in Tuolumne County, he would come across a story about a Calaveras jumping frog contest that was fixed when a guy named Jim Smiley would have his champion frog fed a load of lead shot, unbeknownst to him, to weigh his frog down and send another frog to the winner's circle. But it was Twain's understanding of human dialect, human indifference, and the ability to convey humor from characters that didn't even know they were funny that helped put Twain on the map. He would be sent to the Sandwich Islands, today known as the Hawaiian Islands, as a newspaper correspondent, and then later to Europe and the Holy Land, which would become a series of letters which would be turned into what is my favorite book of his of all time, The Innocents Abroad. This would make him a household name in a reasonably short period of time. So this very brief summation I just gave you covers basically the first half of his life. I basically knew all this, and most people with any biographical sense of Mark Twain know these larger schematic details. Now, I'll talk about what I have gleaned from Ron Chernow's exhaustive work now, at least kind of the vibe that came off of it. Some of it takes a small degree of shine off my favorite author, but I don't find this as upsetting as one might assume. One, I do not overstate this when I say Mark Twain would have never achieved worldwide acclaim without his editor. And by editor, I mean his wife, Olivia Langdon Clemens. And by the end of the book, if you are not in love with her brilliance, temperance, wit, wisdom, and profound dedication to her marriage and family, you are far more callous of a soul than I. There is a tipping point in Chernow's trek that one begins to feel a sense of physical pain for her as she sustains gale force losses, financial, physical, health, in her children. Her angelic presence remains a constant even after her death in the narrative. She was, and is, the Duech Machina, the ghost in the machine. Twain's spiritual cynicism was deeper and more stringent than I realized also. Twain is heralded by atheists as one of their own, and his numerous vituperative criticisms of the Christian faith are used all the time in online quotes to make a point. I will contest he's not an atheist, but he falls into what I would call a Nietzschean Calvinist. I made this up, but it fits in my own head. That mankind was damned to suffer at the hands of a God who was at best indifferent and at worst vindictively cruel. Twain suffered the loss of three children and a wife before dying, so this fundamental bedrock of his beliefs only metastasized as he cascaded toward his own death. The problem lies with the fact that he carried this tendency before all of his heartbreak. His wife, Olivia, was a well-to-do maiden of considerable wealth when Twain met her. She was also a devout Presbyterian who, while smitten with the ruffian Clemens from Hannibal, Missouri, also asked him not to curse and stop smoking cigars and stop drinking whiskey and go to church. Twain cleaned up his act and he got the girl, but he commenced with all of these activities shortly after matrimony, and he continued with these things through their whole marriage and ultimately wore her down, to his own admission. In effect, her love for him superseded her own beliefs, but Sam Clemens was never able to occupy or fill the vacuous shape in her heart that had been caused, and it had a profoundly negative effect on her and her family when Mary Baker Eddy's Christian Science came knocking on the door with its familiar spirits in tow. Another thing I learned is that there is a latent fear in everything that Mark Twain did, and it masked itself in defiance. It's clear that only magical periods of his life were boyhood and then the childhood eras of his own daughters. There is a distinct magic implied in these years, and there is a certain infantilization inside of Twain's own maturity. It's like his spiritual fatalism was tied directly to the encroaching inevitability of time, death, and the entropic stream of sickness, degradation, and chronic illness. He shook his fist at a god that couldn't, or rather wouldn't, interfere with time and trauma. He furthermore admits his own military cowardice, and he claimed that after accepting a challenge to a duel, that he ditched town before he could meet this obligation. I believe it's a piece of work that he wrote called How I Escaped Almost Being Killed in a Duel. And perhaps this is why he tended to hurt those around him, because he recognized himself in the faces of other things that haunted him. And while he would avoid physical fights, his tendency toward litigation and lawsuits was immense, fierce, and well-funded, and was certainly his strong suit. He was a man whose fame paralyzed the functionality of his intimate relationships. You see, Mark Twain was a preternaturally gifted writer and an autodidactic wonder. His ability to absorb information and retain it turned him into a walking human almanac that could hold forth and give speeches on nearly any subject under the sun with great profundity. His travels gave him a large crossover appeal at cosmopolitan levels, despite his relatively simple country southern heritage. The only talent he didn't have would be in business speculation. This involved patents, inventions, and especially an insane financial obligation to an ill-fated typesetting machine that would never, ever make it to mass production, and it would obliterate the Clemenses into bankruptcy. This would include all of Mark Twain's earned income and all of the inheritance of his lovely wife, Livy. The only way out was for Twain to start lecturing on a circuit again in Europe. Twain's daughter Susie would contract bacterial meningitis at age 24 and die at home in Hartford. Twain did not make it home in time to see her buried, and he was destroyed. Her delirious letters written in the throes of death bespeak a giant gulf of regret, and his bankruptcy is the thing that caused him to have to leave and prevent him from ultimately caring for his own daughter. So when we see that the cultural tour de force of Sam Clemens would be thrown into the hands of various handlers when Livy, his wife, died in Italy a few years later. This period of Twain's life is rather complicated, and it drove wedges between Twain and his daughter Clara, as well as daughter Jean, who also, in the endless throes of stigmatizing epilepsy, found herself at the mercy of medical advice and isolation from her father, who sought various treatments, homeopathic cures, and the like, but never brought her closer to him. And by the time he realized his own health was flagging and put his foot down and brought Jean back home, it was basically too little and too late. Jean, who had been deprived of any real relationship with her father, finally had it for a few months before suffering a fatal attack in her bathtub on Christmas Eve, 1909. So Ron Chernow's long narrative brings one to this crux, this moment, and by the time Jean's body is removed from the water, the devastation is complete. Twain is staring at the third indirect victim of his vanities. Perhaps not his fault, but his absence with Susie during her death, his spiritual acidity during his wife's, and his hands-off hiatus delegations to handlers, doctors, and experts for Jean marked a literal grand slam of regret. His greatest assets were his family, not his otherworldly ability to wield the pen. And for me, despite my familiarity with the story, my own heart was broken reading this book for all of them. I landed at the text and her funeral with an attendant German shepherd named Fix, mourning her passing and peering over the top of a casket, and tears in my own eyes as I read this. Now, I've glossed over many things here, and I highly recommend Ron Chernow's book, Get It. It's a long read, but not fatiguing by any stretch. It feels like you're there, and that's the tough part for me because I feel like I was there for all of it. Lastly, Mark Twain would write one more book, which would not be published until long after his death and only at the hands of his extremely reluctant daughter, Clara, who felt it would misrepresent who he was. But his only living offspring was the one who put it into motion. It's called Letters from Earth, an embittered indictment of the Bible, creation, Adam and Eve, purpose, and especially a malevolent creator. God is portrayed as an uninterested father who cares not for the daily struggle of his children, leaving them to languish in their torment by themselves. As I said, Twain's anger came from fear, and on the heels of Jean's death, he may have been too intoxicated with his own grief to see himself in the written indictment that he published, or the fatalistic spirit of his own fatherly neglect moving above the bathtub water, at least until it was too late. Ron Chernow's book will haunt me for a while, but it's a good thing. Trust me, this is box number 7.